Investors Chronicle.
Hello, Happy New Year, and welcome back to Lee and the IC. I'm Alex Newman, an associate editor at the Investors Chronicle, and I'm really pleased to be here in the FT studios again for my first conversation with Lord John Lee of 2024. This is our fifth episode, so the quick disclaimer I'm about to make will be familiar to anyone who's listened before. Everything we talk about in this podcast is filtered through the thoughts, actions, feelings, and experience of one of the most seasoned personal investors in the country, which means while our discussion is intended purely as an educational tool, we're often giving a couple of angles in the multitude of views that make up a market. Also, nothing in this podcast should be taken as financial advice or a recommendation to buy or sell shares. This month, we're going to return to our regular format by taking a deep dive into one of the stocks John owns and how it fits in with his broader view of the UK economy and current investing options. We're also going to discuss some of the biggest changes in investing in the more than six decades John's been managing his own money, and concluding with a roundup of the goings-on in his portfolio. Anyway, let's get to it. John, a very warm welcome to you today and a belated Happy New Year. How are you doing?
And Happy New Year to you and to all listeners.
Indeed. So let's kick off with our focus stock this month, Secure Trust Bank, which is the one I wanted to talk about. So with a market value of £130 million, this is by some distance the smallest company we've so far chosen for a deep dive. And as such, I'm just going to assume the listeners aren't entirely familiar with the group, though I'm sure many are. So just to bring us up to speed, could you just briefly introduce Secure Trust, what it does, and your involvement as an investor?
Yes, well, Secure Trust is a fully-fledged banking business, taking deposits from retail customers and lending, and it has a very well-balanced lending portfolio. It has a slightly curious genesis or origin in that really it was for a number of years effectively owned and controlled by Arbuthnot Latham, the larger banking firm, private banking firm, although Arbuthnot is public. And then gradually developed its independence, and Arbuthnot sold down their stake. And so now I think I'm right in saying that Arbuthnot doesn't have any holding at all in Secure Trust. So it travels and lives independently. It's basically a very conservatively run business and bank. I've been in it for a few years, and I paid a couple of years ago up to £12 for the shares, but with smaller banks being out of favour and the decline in the small cap sector generally, they came down to just over £5, and I bought again or more at lower prices. 575 was my lowest buy, at around 600p. In other words, about half of what I was paying 2 years ago. So it's quite extraordinary, despite the fact that the business has grown and expanded. So the net result at the current £7 level is that I think they are ridiculously undervalued. The P ratio is around 5 or even less than that, dependent on what forecast one takes. The dividend yield is about 6.5%. When I was buying it a little bit lower, it was yielding around 7%. And they're very, very conservative on dividend payout. The dividend is covered 4 times, and that's their policy, which I think personally is a little bit on the excessive side, although, I'm all for caution and conservative approach with banks. But I don't think they need 4 times cover. So, they could release even more if they wanted to by way of dividend, which, would help. Could help to bring back the shares, but the rating is, I think, very, very low indeed, and everyone acknowledges that, really totally without justification. Just looking over the next 2 or 3 years, if they don't manage to get the rating and value up, then I think they are very vulnerable to a takeover from a larger banking or financial business. Oh, and the other point to make, I think, is that the asset value, and this is a hard asset value, excluding goodwill and similar, is £17 a share. So we've got a £17 NAV against a £7 share price.
Yeah, so within UK banking, for for those listeners who might not be specialists, for some years now, we've had these very steep discounts to book value or tangible book value, which is sometimes what people look at with banking stocks. And I think I'm right in saying that they are, well, that would put them in close to 70%, so almost a sort of two-thirds discount.
A huge discount.
So in other words, investors in the markets are saying that this is a business that's only going to destroy asset value or equity value in the future, which obviously we can, you know, we can come on to, and some of the reasons why a secure trust would say that that's not going to happen. Just to take a step back, I suppose the nuts and bolts of this for the, you know, for a non-bank specialist or someone who's just looking at a secure trust and maybe comparing them to more familiar names, you know, does business finance, retail finance, real estate backed finance, short-term credit and savings accounts, these are all pretty standard product lines for a bank. So why is secure trust like or unlike the high street UK names that people might be a bit more familiar with?
Well, they would say, and you know, I believe them, that they are more conservative than most banks. You know, I think a couple of years ago, you know, that they decided to become even more conservative, you know, being conscious that the economy is going to go through a difficult period and customers are going to go through a difficult period with high interest rates. And therefore, obviously, they wanted to avoid excessive risk and potential bad debts. And so they have been very conservative in their lending. The 4x dividend cover, I think, you know, is indicative of that. I can't think of another financial group with that size of cover. And also on their unsecured lending, it is very focused. So, for example, they do specialize in lending on jewelry and also furniture, you know, which they believe are you know, that much more secure, as it were, and less of a risk than other sectors. So within their overall lending, they do adopt, and I believe they do adopt, you know, a far more conservative approach.
And I suppose compared to the high street banks, they're not in the mortgage game in the way that you know, the sort of NatWest, Lloyds, Barclays, etc. are. And as you point out, I suppose this is one of the opportunities for the banking sector, that if you have a niche product line, jewellery, secondhand car finance, for example, and there's not the scale that would interest the appetites of the larger players, then that is an opportunity to potentially make above average returns and good interest income.
And I think they see a clear path ahead to grow the business.
Yeah.
You know, I think in their capital markets presentation, their lending, I think, was over the 3 billion mark. And I think, you know, they're aiming to get it up over the next 2 or 3 years to 4 billion or something like that. So that there is a growth plan, but hopefully adopting all along the line the conservative approach.
With banking, in essence, it's about lending at a higher rate, isn't it, than you are paying to your depositors, all while managing all these complex things like capital, your cost base and risk. In the case of secure trust, their deposits, they draw a lot from retail customers via fixed-term bonds, ISAs and access accounts. And that's a really competitive market here, isn't it? And they can't sit on their hands in the way that, say, a NatWest can, because NatWest, for example, can bank on the inertia of people, people's sort of current accounts not wanting to move them. How do they navigate something?
You know, that's really a detailed question. I think you'd have to ask them. You know, obviously, I'm a little more broad brush as an investor, but coming back, of course, to the net asset value of £17, they have quite a lot of their own capital to lend out as well, which obviously is beneficial. And I don't believe that they take deposits, wholesale deposits, from the market generally, as it were. But I think they've got a very loyal band of retail depositors who've presumably been with them for a long time. And, you know, like the, I suspect, a slightly higher rate of interest that they get than they would get from deposits with a bank.
Yeah. I noticed their chairman, Lord Forsyth, I was just looking through the annual report, whose career as an MP and subsequently as a Lord sort of overlapped a little bit with your career in Parliament. Is Lord Forsyth someone you know well?
Yes, I know him well. He's chairman of the Association of Conservative Peers. He's probably one of the most respected and active peers at Westminster, challenges his own government from time to time, and very much focused on the financial world. I think he was with, after his ministerial career, I think I'm right in saying he was with Solomon Brothers for
a
period, and is heavily plugged into the financial world. So I would have thought he brings, good guidance to Secure Trust. And the chief executive there, David McCready, who I talk to from time to time, he's a very cautious, solid in the nicest way, traditional banker, Scottish banker, I believe, or even better, and even more cautious. So all in all, I think it's an attractive investment story and opportunity, and is I would say a useful holding of mine, delivering me a very nice dividend.
Is it a stock that you own as a play on the UK economy, or do you just look at it in terms of the business itself and what it can do, rather than a bet on the UK economic GDP growth or whatever it may be?
No, I'm focused very much on individual companies. And I'm not too concerned with the macro aspect, because the whole point is with investing in smaller cap stocks that even if the country isn't booming, as it were, they can still do very well in the niches that they're in. And actually, I would say the majority of my small cap holdings over the last few months, those who reported have actually, reported that they're trading well. Concurrent technologies, we might talk on a little bit later, Hollywood Bowl, for example, Nichols, Vimto, all these have been reporting quite a good underlying growth in profits. So I take the view with Secure Trust that there is an opportunity for them to grow as a niche business, fundamentally significantly undervalued as far as I can see, and I've not come across any major negative with them. And so many in my portfolio, small caps in my portfolio, I think that it's a sort of an each way bet that either they will grow and develop, or a predator will come along, and this 2024 could well be the year of the takeover.
Banking shares have always been a mainstay of the UK market at various sizes and scales. Have you always adopted that approach to this sector in terms of sizing and a niche focus, or have you invested in banks at both ends of the scale?
No, I haven't invested in larger banks, the high street banks.
Why is that?
Basically, because they are and have been subject to government interference. If you recall, there was a directive that banks shouldn't pay any dividends, for example,
during the pandemic.
During the pandemic, and so there is, I think, a much greater governmental influence there, as it were, whereas the niche players have a rather greater degree of freedom, if we get a change of government, a more left of centre government comes in, then I would have thought, if anything, they'd be probably even more involved or more potentially controlling. So I tend to steer clear of the high street banks. But a niche bank like Secure Trust within my overall portfolio is quite comfortable from my point of view.
It's an interesting point, I think, because it's a criticism often levelled at the UK banking sector that, because of its very tight connections to the property market, that it is this kind of quasi-state sector, and very hard to unpack its relationship with government going forward. But stepping outside the very, very high-profile banks maybe a way for investors to sort of play finance, which is...
That certainly is more my focus.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, bank shares, might be a constant, throughout your investing career or in the market, but a lot else has changed, John. And that kind of brings me to the topic I wanted to talk to you about this month, which is, I suppose, in broad terms, the modern history of private investing and the changes you've seen since you started managing your own money. I mean, there have been lots of big innovations in the world of private investing in, I suppose, the past half century, but the rise of, we've not really talked about this much on the podcast before, the rise of passive investing and indexation, and I suppose the demise of the private investor that has involved, might be the biggest of those changes. Warren Buffett once said that Jack Bogle, who founded Vanguard, the index provider, had done more for the individual American investor than anyone in history. Do you share that enthusiasm for the way that indexation and the popularization of passive investing has drawn more people in, or has that been to the detriment of, broader investing, private investing culture?
Well, I think as far as most people are concerned, having vehicles like Vanguard and others where larger funds track or handle people's monies, as it were, obviously it makes it easier for people, and but therefore one can well understand the growth of those vehicles. But I do think personally it's a pity, and I've certainly endeavoured to do what I can to encourage the personal investor and the private investor, and sadly those taking their own decisions have been in decline, and I would accept that. But I think it's a pity, because I think most people do assume that that one needs to spend a huge amount of time to handle one's own portfolio, or it's extremely difficult or extremely complicated. Whereas I personally believe that there are only two things that you need for successful investing, and that is patience and common sense. And patience is the most important. And of course, sadly, with many of the small caps, they have required a lot of patience, really, with the way they have drifted down in value over the last 2 or 3 years. And thus, I believe at the moment, do present a considerable buying opportunity. And then, of course, I think regulations have also played a part as well. There's far less freedom now for stockbroking firms and similar to recommend individual stocks. They have to be approved by their credit committees or investment committees. Individuals in broking firms are very reluctant to put their neck out. When I first started in stockbroking many years ago, the senior partner would buy a line of shares in X, and then in the afternoon, phone a whole range of clients and say, look, I've bought this line of shares, I really like the story, I really think you should have some. So there's a much more personal involvement, and today it's much more formalized and much more institutional. I think it's a great pity, really. And also I think on a broader canvas, I think we all accept that financial education, our schools, separate topic, is really very, very limited at best. Nothing has really encouraged the retail investor. And then another hobby horse of mine, I really do think it's a tragedy that our main TV channels, indeed virtually all our TV channels, have never covered the stock market or investment opportunities. And we've got some great businesses in the UK which would make very interesting television and present great investment opportunities, but these really aren't brought into people's homes. And so I think the lack of television involvement has played quite a big part in this.
One medium which did used to do this, to an extent still does, the print media. I was just looking back kind of to the beginning of your career as a private investor, to the early 60s, and reading accounts of Jim Slater's capitalist column in the Telegraph. I mean, it seems that was a moment where private investing really captured the popular imagination. Obviously, the circulation of daily newspapers was a lot wider, and therefore there's a kind of a network effect there of more people reading about exciting shares. But at the same time, that was a time of higher frictional costs to private investors, broking fees and the like. Was that popularity really evident at the time, do you think? And what has changed? Is it a case of that was the Jim Slater capitalist column was at the time the equivalent of, cryptomania, in that there were, he was able to, for a period, able to spot you know, very high rising shares, and no one can do that forever. And actually, patience will always wane once the, you know, the optimism subsides.
I think that's it's probably true. I think there has been a decline in well, it's been obviously a decline in readership of traditional newspapers anyway, as it were. But within that, I think there has been a decline in the city sections. I mean, there are one or two exceptions, but I think you're right. I think also, sadly, over the years in this country, for a mix of reasons, we haven't really developed and encouraged the sort of the entrepreneurial investor or businessman. I think, for example, in America, the stock market is much more frequently talked about, you know, by your average person, and you only have to look at the numbers of people who go to Warren Buffett's AGM, as it were, thousands, to hear, you know, the great man talk. Not obviously, things haven't been helped, obviously, by things that have gone wrong, like the Woodford saga, for example. But as I say, I think the excess of regulation, and I'm all for you know, protecting against, you know, serious and gross abuse, but I think overall it's gone too far, and this is why I come back to you know, the total failure of television, which was, after all, the dominant media and still is, as far as many people with money or money to invest is concerned. You know, all this has played a part. And I know there have been delegations to see the Chancellor of the Exchequer and from the city, you know, to try and encourage him to do something to actually, you know, bring about a change in mood. And there's been a suggestion of an ISA that should be just British or Britain-focused to try and encourage UK investment to stimulate the stock market. So there are a number of things that can be done. But I agree with you that there has been a decline in sort of private investing, and I hope that somehow we can reverse that.
Just to return to the long-term passive story, just by devil's advocate a little bit, I mean, when it comes to the kind of investing you do, John, I wonder if some people might ask the question, you know, one, why not settle for the market average? Because, you know, over time that tends to be better than just putting it in a savings account, and buy a cheap global or UK equity tracker, whatever it is, and you know, just spend more time doing non-investing things. So I suppose that's one question. The other one, you know, you like businesses that are conservatively managed. One, I suppose, conservative approach to the management of one's own personal finances is to say, well, I like this intellectual exercise of investing. It, you know, I feel really engaged in the world, and I'm learning lots all the time, and how the world changes. But I'm worried about overweighting my own ability to sift through the tsunami of information and price points and valuation cases, and just sifting that market's worth of companies' information it seems so daunting that I'm just going to delegate it to, you know, a passive product, which sort of filters in an average way for me. Can you understand?
I can understand that totally. You know, obviously a lot of people have gone down that route and will go down that route, but of course they pay for it. You know, there are initial upfront fees in investing in these products, and then usually an annual fee. I mean, fees have, as a generalisation, been coming down, because I think the feeling was that fund management, you know, was too lucrative. But I think there is a clear decision that individuals have to make. Are they you know, prepared to spend a little time on their own portfolio? Do they enjoy taking their own decisions and learning? Or do they essentially want someone else to do it for them? You know, that is a fundamental decision that people have to take. Now, in my case, for example, you know, I love the individual businesses that I'm involved in. You know, I live them, I breathe them, I keep in contact with them. If anything, I think I could be criticised probably for being too loyal to many of the companies, or some of the companies that I'm invested in. But you know, nevertheless, to me, I've had a huge amount of satisfaction and pleasure and interest from being a private investor. You know, I like to think I've done overall as well, if not a little better than I would have done had I invested in, you know, through a some form of larger fund. But each to their own. That has to be basically the message. But I'm all for encouraging more private investors.
And I mean, we should make the point as well, passive investing is not just a one-way street, is it? There's often sub-decisions to make within that, you know, how much are you allocating to various passive themes or kinds of assets. So it's not necessarily as straightforward as...
It's not necessarily straightforward. And then, of course, you know, certain individuals who are regarded as investment stars attract a huge amount of following, or take a company like Scottish Mortgage, for example,
yeah,
you know, which has had a tremendous track record. And everyone was therefore saying, you know, we must put money in Scottish Mortgage, and commentators were saying that. And I know many, many people who, you know, bought Scottish Mortgage. You know, to me, Scottish Mortgage had a great record, but I thought that really its best days were in the past.
Right.
And a lot of people who went in the last two or three years have, you know, lost significant amounts of money. Now, you know, Scottish Mortgage may well come again, probably will, but, you know, I'm not sure the glory days of yesteryear will be replicated.
Another big, maybe the final big shift I just want to touch on has been, well, at least until a couple of years ago, has been for 40 years of generally a falling rate environment. I mean, we're now back on a more historically normalised footing for interest rates, if you believe what many economists and investors now think is going to persist for the coming years. What have you made, I suppose, of this 40-year window? And maybe the more important question here is, have you found your pre-1980s investing muscle memories sort of kicking back in now that we're in a high interest rate environment? I know you said you don't always pay attention to the macro. It's not a determinant for your investment.
Well, I remember in my stockbroking years, we're going back, I think, to the 1960s, early 60s, interest rates were up to about 15%. And I remember some huge debentures and loan stock yields at that stage. So over my 60 or 70 years of investing, you know, I've seen interest rates up and down. You know, one seen three or four significant bear markets. But overall, I like to think that that one has seen a growth in equities and a growth in dividends as well, and certainly, you know, I've benefited over the years. But obviously, interest rates do play a big part, and of course, now we are in I think it's accepted that we're now going to see a falling of interest rates. But obviously, this is subject to the world situation, and it's a dangerous world out there. There are so many flashpoints. The world is a tinderbox, I'm afraid. But insofar as commentators are agreed on one thing, it is that we are moving to a lower interest rate period, and you know, there should be some interest rate cuts during 2024. Now, that's going to mean that private equity business is going to be able, I think, to use debt, cheaper debt, to actually become more active and fund and finance takeover bids and similar. And that's why I think that 2024 could well be a year of the takeover. And certainly, I'd be surprised and disappointed if, you know, come December this year, you know, I hadn't been on the receiving end of one or two takeovers, because when I looked through my portfolio, you know, I realise that so many are vulnerable because of the low level of UK small caps, particularly.
Just to, I suppose, round that point on, which I've neglected to do earlier on Secure Trust. I mean, you would obviously have to pay a premium if you were going to buy that business, but £130 million for a profitable UK bank, fully regulated, fully licensed, doesn't seem like a huge price for, you know, vis-a-vis Mars buying Hotel Chocolat. They obviously want to do something different with that business. If you had a very big entity looking to make a splash in the UK, potentially, that's, you know, it's almost a rounding error, isn't it?
Well, you're paying 130 million for for, we believe, hard assets of probably, you know, probably 300 million or something like that. So there's a lot to go at.
Yeah, but I suppose the point being that, you know, the asset of a bank license, which is hard to come by, is never really factored into the
price of banks, that is quite true. And so, you know, we'd obviously be looking to, I would have thought, if there is a predator there, it would probably be an existing bank or an existing, you know, financially approved business, as it were, because, yes, as you say, people, no one could just sort of wander in from the street and however wealthy and just buy a bank without any vetting or approval these days. And that's a good thing.
So let's conclude, as we often do, with a roundup of other goings on in your portfolio. Let's start with Treat, which we discussed at length in our second episode in October. I mean, since then, we've had a bit of change in the C-suite and full year results. Have you been following things?
Yes, absolutely. So I was pleased that, you know, profits came out broadly as expected, and the dividend was edged forward very, very slightly, as it were, although obviously it's on a low dividend yield. But, you know, I've got considerable confidence in the new finance director. So the new chief executive, or he's technically interim chief executive, Ryan Govender, who came in as finance director from ABF, Associated British Foods. And I think he was instrumental in bringing down the debt very substantially and reducing the headcount in Treat by about 14%. I don't see any great growth this year, certainly not in the, you know, in the first part. But I think long term, you know, Treat is well positioned. I think the opportunities, particularly because I, you know, obviously keep in touch with them, I think the opportunities, particularly in the I mean, they're very big in America. The UK and US are pretty well equal, I think, in many respects. But the potential in China is for them, I think, is very considerable. There are some huge privately owned drinks businesses in China that we've never heard of. I think Treat see a considerable opportunity there for them. So although the shares have come down quite a lot, they've started to recover. And I'm very much firmly aboard. But, you know, here again, the present capitalization, it does make them vulnerable.
Yeah. Second, though, I suppose it's a cluster of companies here. Given the large role they've come to play in your portfolio, it would probably be remiss of me not to check in on the life insurers, the M&Gs, Aviva's, LNG's and Phoenix. I think you have some exposure to
yes, all these.
I mean, particularly given how much interest rate expectations have swung around in the last few months, but more generally just because of their heft within your portfolio. What's been your take there? Have you been trimming things? Have you been adding to positions? Or
neither adding nor reducing, but certainly maintaining.
Yeah.
You know, I feel very comfortable being in that grouping, M&G, being invested in that grouping, M&G, Aviva, Legal & General, Phoenix. You know, I think the prices have been edging up, so their yields have been coming down a little, but even so are still very, very attractive. You know, I'm obviously waiting as a private investor for April, May, because most of these companies have got December year ends, so you actually get the dividend, the real dividend flow coming through in April, May. And, you know, some of those payouts are going to be, you know, very substantial. And I'm looking forward to, you know, to from most of them, modest dividend increases on an already high yield. So I feel very comfortable with having them in my portfolio, particularly, of course, in my ISA, where it's all tax-free.
And that's the cash cow that you would look to redeploy potentially into other companies.
Correct. That at the moment, you know, I'm able to reinvest the majority of the dividend income within the ISA, and so you get the benefit of compounding. You know, in the old days, looking back, when takeovers, you know, were more frequent, and I think I've said before that I've been on the receiving end of about 60. Takeovers or take privates, that's given new liquidity, as it were, to buy into new companies or add to existing ones. But now, obviously, a really good dividend flow does enable me to do that.
I think one of the companies you said you recycled some of the M&G dividends into last time, or the interim dividend, was Concurrent Technologies.
Correct.
So there's the Colchester headquartered designer, manufacturer of ruggedized embedded processes to a range of markets. On a very downbeat day for markets, they had put out a pretty strong trading update saying the revenues and adjusted profits would exceed expectations. You're obviously pretty bullish on this company, John. We're also hoping to have their CEO, Miles Adcock, join us on the podcast next month. What did you make of their trading update?
I was very pleased. I think that they only just talked about the overall figures, as it were, but I think there are a number of underlying stories within Concurrent and what is happening, even in terms of orders and development. Following on from their acquisition of Philips Aerospace in the US, giving them a base there, because their business is I think around 90% export from the UK. The majority of the biggest market is America and American defence, and obviously all defence stocks have really had a good run. As I said before, the world is very, very dangerous. Defence spend in so many countries is increasing, it's an ill wind, as they say, but Miles, I think, I know, has actually really transformed Concurrent and changed things dramatically in terms of speed of product development, in terms of bringing in, as he believes, better quality people overall, making the acquisition in the US. And I think they're now on the runway, as it were, and I'd be very disappointed if they didn't really fly over the next 2, 3, 4 years. But Miles, hopefully in February in the podcast, will tell us more.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it, and sort of seeing one of your investment sort of relationships in person. Lots to explore in that episode, which of course can include any questions you'd like to put to John or Miles, I suppose, if you want to get in touch to ask us questions directly on Concurrent. You can do that by emailing me at alex.newman@ft.com. Until then, all that's left for me to say is to thank you for listening. Thank you, John, again for your thoughts and time today.
My pleasure.
And to thank our producer, Maddie Apthorpe, for all her work behind the soundboard. Until next time.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.